This is the Big Web Show. Everything web that matters. We talk about everything here in this in the world of the web. And this show is hosted by Jeffrey Zeldman, none other than Jeffrey Zeldman of HavyCogZeldman.com, and by me, Dan Benjamin. And this episode is sponsored by Sound Studio 4. This lets you record, edit, and produce your audio with Sound Studio, an easy-to-use Mac app for recording and editing digital audio on your computer. Record professional-sounding podcasts, spoken words, speeches, presentations, you name it, all in high fidelity and high quality. And then you can export to all of your favorite formats, Wave, AAC, Ogg Vorbis, heard of that one, and more. And you can get this from the Mac App Store today. We'd also like to thank MailChimp.com, powerful email marketing. They let you send 6,000 emails per month to a list of up to 1,000 people for free. How do they do that? I don't know. And they've been working with some of the best designers on the web to create beautiful email templates that anyone can use. You just drop your content in, and it just works. It's really amazing. Help us destroy their servers by everybody going right now to MailChimp.com/5x5. Do it now and take them down. We will crush them. So thanks to them for sponsoring. And hey, Jeffrey Zeldman, how are you today?
You won't crush them. They are hosted by Happy Cog Hosting.
Well, we've got to try. Let's put it to the test.
You will not crush them.
Let's put it to the test, big man. Let's see what happens.
I like that Ogg Vorbis. I hear that Google is going to stop supporting MP3 and only support Ogg Vorbis because, they're going to do the video as Ogg Vorbis also.
No kidding. Everything's Ogg now.
On the phone.
Everything's Ogg.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's going to be good. I like how 90s-like everything is getting to be these days. And speaking of the 90s, hey, we've got Mike Essel.
Mike Essel.
And hi. What I mean by that is not that Mike Essel is like a tattooed, mean MF, like with hardcore metal punk 90s attitude, although that's true. But that Mike and I made friends in the 90s during the first format wars that were so much fun in this medium. Mike was the, I forget the name. Oh, yes, the Chopping Block, like the... For many years, and possibly still, the hottest agency in New York. I don't know. Now I have to assume that anything I do is the hottest, and I pretend there are no. But Chopping Block may still be the hottest agency in New York. They're really fantastic.
I think they're out of business.
They're out of business.
From what I hear, there's one guy and a website. That's it.
That's sad.
Yeah, it's okay. A little sad. I'll be honest. It makes me kind of happy.
Well, you co-founded that agency. In like 1996 or something, and you guys made They Might Be Giants' first website, and it was before the days of Flash, and you had turned a handle and the heads of the two Johns. There were some characters from their songs that I don't remember what it was. Kind of, you know, today we would say it was Mystery Meat Navigation, but I think it was They Might Be Giants. It wasn't like a cancer treatment center, and it was kind of cool that you went to this website and went, what the hell is this? And had a lot of fun exploring it, because that's really a lot about what their music is about. If any band from the 90s played head games with the audience and was looking for, you know, it was just a perfect correlative. And of course, you've done many, many other things since you left that. You run you actually were at competing design schools in New York. I'm at SVA, and you're at a little place called Cooper Union, where you head the graphic design program and where you are a tenured associate professor. I don't know the whole – my title is faculty, although I believe after like 20 years, they call you like tenured faculty or something. They don't have titles as far as I know, but you guys – But it's like, it's weird. Like, I think when you're 100, when you're there for 100 years, you'll be like a half associate professor or a senior associate.
I started as an assistant professor, and then they make you, and when you get tenure, you become an associate professor. And then I can go up again, sort of go up for promotion, they call it, and I can become what's called a full professor, where my title would simply be professor. It's a bit complicated, but those are the tiers at most universities, I guess.
And you're not a... I used to be a designer professor. It's what Cooper Union is, but you're a passionate, engaged designer doing a lot of other stuff. You have we've talked a lot about books on this show, and I'm going to want to hear about your book experiences, but let's start with Mr. T.
Okay.
So,
go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You and a friend.
I have the world's – well, I'm the co-owner of the world's largest Mr. T memorabilia collection. So it's about 5,000 pieces of Mr. T memorabilia. I collect it with a friend, Greg Rivera, who I met on eBay because we were competing with each other so much for Mr. T stuff. So yeah, we both collect together. We run the website MrTandMe.com. You can also get there by going to ipitythefool.com or pitythefool.com, if you will.
Very nice.
And right now, it used to be a showcase of our collection, but we've turned it into more of like a Mr. T blog on Tumblr. So that's been fun. And behind me, you'll see I have this wall in my house that's entirely covered from floor to ceiling in Mr. T. See?
I should say for our readers right off the bat, for our listeners who are new or who might not be familiar with Mike, in spite of what he just said, he is happily married to an absolutely lovely woman.
Thank you.
So contrary to what you might be led to believe. So this particular kind of, you know, it looks like the 40-year-old version, but
I'm doing okay.
You're doing very well, my friend. Yes. And you met Mr. T, I believe, correct?
I have. I was at a – he appeared on Howard Stern, and when I heard that he was promoting a autograph signing at Planet Hollywood, I stood in line for about 2 hours. I got him to sign, you know, this toy I brought with me. We had a brief conversation, and then about 20 minutes later, I cried my eyes out for – I was just like hysterically sobbing because I love the guy so much. So
some people looking at this from the outside might say this is a goof. Here's this like super downtown, you know, downtown New York, Brooklyn type guy, art director, shaved head, tattoos. Obviously, the Mr. T thing is a put on of some kind. This is just some kind of fancy hipsterism, some kind of ironic thing. But it's not at all, right? This is not ironic.
No irony at all. When I was a kid, let's just say my parents were like minor league drug dealers. So Mr. T was the only adult in my life saying not to do drugs and to stay in school. And, you know, it was in my 30s when I first tried pot, and I'm a college professor. So as far as staying in school and not doing drugs, I maybe paid a little bit too much attention to Mr. T.
That's a wonderful story. That's amazing.
It really.
Did you tell him that?
He knows that. There was an article in the Washington Post about me and Greg and the collection, and they actually interviewed Mr. T about me, which I have to say is one of the highlights of my whole life. And the thing Mr. T said that was so great is he said, "I'm so happy he received my message. I can't wait to tell my mother."
Wow,
it's just so great.
See, we could be done right now.
Right, exactly. I can die happy.
I'm happy. I'm happy that we did this show. We could stop the show, Dan. Do you realize that?
Well, thanks, everybody. We want to thank
MailChimp
for sponsoring today's episode.
But seriously, we're not. It's going to be hard to beat that. But do you think – I know that I without disrespecting anyone's privacy, I mean, I had some trouble in my background and a struggle to find myself. You didn't have a problem with my child is home. So you didn't have a problem with drugs, but,
right.
But you did indirectly, you in a family connection. I wonder, there are so many creative people I know who have some kind of background that's, I don't know whether everyone in the world is touched by this kind of tragedy or just the creative people I know, but it seems like a lot of creative people I know, there's something broken back there that maybe helps you look at the world a little differently and be creative. Maybe if you had a perfect upbringing, if such a thing existed, you wouldn't feel the need to reinvent websites or, you know, music or whatever it is that you're driven to do.
I think as a kid, I turned in to my work. You know, I remember late nights just drawing and doing my homework for my art classes. And I remember that becoming the you know, the, I guess the place where I would go when things got a little strange, let's say. So I don't disagree with you. I mean, I think that that really pushed me into art in a way that it might not have otherwise. I also think because creative people maybe are, I don't mean to generalize, but are maybe a bit more open. I think we hear about it more from creative people. You know what I mean? True.
Yes, yeah. I did. So I mean, I had a similar experience of having some kind of problem going on and that I turned away from and drew. I had this whole comic book series with a character called Rick Purvis that I, from comic to comic, you know, and basically every 2 months I could draw better. So I had him have plastic surgery to rationalize to my imagined readers
why he looked
better. But yeah, that was probably my creative peak, I've got to say. But it certainly wasn't yours. Let's talk about books a little bit. You're you know, besides Mr. T, you have an affinity for pop culture generally, and you've done some of the definitive books for Batman and so on. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I do. I actually have two practices, like what I consider distinct practices, which are I have a book design practice with a friend, Sasha Tachalowski. And we operate under the name Meat, M-E-A-T, and we do books together. And then I have, which we'll talk about later, I think, is Nerd Duo, which is where I do my web work together. And I do that with Rob Ergang. And the book work, it's interesting. I got out of graduate school mostly, you know, known as a web designer. And a friend of mine at Chronicle Books, Brett McFadden, he offered a book to me right out of graduate school to design. That book was Weirdo Deluxe, which... We ended up doing a design for that book that used really elaborate custom lettering for all the artist names. And, you know, as a result of that book kind of looking the way it did, Chronicle just continued to hire me. So after that book, I did a book called The Art of Batman Begins, which was like an art book about the first Nolan Batman movie. And what happened there is I was able to meet the people in publishing at DC Comics and hit it off with them. And since then, I've been able to do about 15 books total in my career now. The majority for DC Comics, some for Rizzoli, some for Chronicle. The most known book I've done is I co-authored a book with Chip Kidd and David Gibbons, the author of The Watchmen. And we did the book Watching the Watchmen, which is a behind-the-scenes look at the making of the Watchmen comic book, not the movie.
Now, I again, with two practices, I hear two kinds of activity in your book design. It sounds to me, correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. It sounds to me like the book you did with Chip Kidd and Dave would be more curatorial. You know, you would have an art directional role, but you would also have a curatorial role mm-hmm. in figuring out what pieces belong and how should they be sequenced and what doesn't belong and what are the relationships. Whereas maybe in the Batman Begins book for Michael Nolan, not Michael mm-hmm. Nolan,
Chris Nolan,
Christopher Nolan, right?
Yep.
Maybe it was more of a, here's what I, you know, it's Christopher Nolan for Pete's sake. Here's what I want. Make this happen, Essel, and then you design it. Is that true?
I have a funny story about that. Actually, the way it usually works, actually, almost with all the books is, I guess curate is a good word. I like to say that I find the book in the material. Usually what happens is a publisher drops off about 15 DVDs just filled with images, like loose. Sometimes they're sorted, sometimes not. And then we get the manuscript, and then I do my best to flow the book based on the manuscript and place the images. I mean, all book designers do this. What's funny about the Christopher Nolan connection is that I also did the book for The Dark Knight, and I had a meeting where it was the art director of the movie and his assistant, and they were on video chat, and I was in the offices at DC Comics, and at the end of it, they said, okay, so what we'll do is we'll have Mike come in, and we'll have the art director stand behind him, and the art director will help Mike figure out how to lay out the book, and they'll do it all at the art director's house. And, you know, I said, okay, great. And then we ended the call, and then I looked at DC Comics, and I said, okay, I quit. So when you find someone who can put up with these shenanigans, you let me know. And when that happened, about a week later, they hired me back and got rid of all the people from Warner Brothers who tried to get involved in the design. So I would say no. There are art directors on the other end, but I don't really take projects unless I can have like a lot of creative control. I know it sounds like I'm a spoiled brat, but I just can't.
It sounds like you're a director. It sounds like you're a director, and I would think film directors either respect that or they would go the other way and say, hey, you know, I'm the director, and you're a professional subject to my vision. So I heard there were many Inception-like activities connected with that book.
Yeah, anyway. I showed that book, I think, with you at this AIGA event, and because Heath Ledger passed away in the middle of making that book, it got very crazy very fast. It was maybe the worst book, as far as management, the worst book I've ever been involved in, and that it started and stopped maybe four or five times.
So. Didn't they, at one point, if I remember this correctly, they had, they would send you to an FTP site, not a website. There were no thumbnails. You'd have to download these multiple gigabyte files with no thumbnails, no idea what you were downloading. And when you finished downloading them, each of the images was watermarked like a million times, like had Warner Brothers diagonally printed all over it so that you couldn't actually place it in the book. And it would then have to be matched somehow by someone, probably you, at 3 a.m. with a non-watermarked version of the same photo, which was up with a different file name in a different FTP site, which I didn't have access to.
Yeah, my favorite part of all that was that it's not the first time I've dealt with I did the Art of Superman Returns as well, and that had the same watermark issues. But the difference between that book and Dark Knight is that when they finally delivered the high res for Dark Knight, they were a different size than the low res. So, yes, I had to place them all back in the book again. So, yeah, that book was awful.
Because web designers, and you do both, web designers often increasingly look with envy at print designers. They're like, that's so simple. There's, we have to wrestle with all this technology and all these incompatibilities and all these unknowns. But, gosh, it's so easy to be a printer, pick a font. Right? How hard can it be?
Well, what's funny is that I was just going to say my web experience really helps in print because you can JavaScript InDesign, you can automate so much in InDesign that there's one book I did, the DC Comics Action Figure Archive, where I worked with my Nerd Duo partner. He wrote a script that basically laid out and typeset all 200 pages for me. So there's more overlap than you'd expect, actually.
That sounds like a good script to have.
Yeah, it was really good.
Did anyone think, well, now that we've done that, why don't we just, why don't we make the ebook? We have it here. We have a script. Ebook is just HTML. Here we have the script. Why don't we make a website that's, basically already, let's make some CSS rules that will reflow that. And did anyone, I guess you weren't hired to do that, but do you ever bring up something like that and say, hey,
I've
guys,
been trying.
You're doing this? Yeah.
Yeah. I try. I will say publishers, it's a cliche to say it, but they really don't get the internet at all. I mean, I'm doing a book right now where I think they finally decided not to include a DVD of the material and to make a website for it. So the idea that they even considered printing on a DVD or putting data on a DVD disc is, I don't mean to laugh, but it's pretty hilarious.
I haven't
bought a DVD in ages. Go ahead.
No, it's just, when you buy DVDs, you can buy a special DVD that lets you download a digital file.
Oh, right.
Because if you use Handbrake, you're breaking the law to record. If you record, and the technology is not hard, if you record the DVD that you've paid for to use for yourself on your laptop, that's bad. But if you pay a little extra for a DVD with like a special magic link, you can, I'm not an intellectual property lawyer. There's two issues really, because there are some publishers definitely who are behind the curve in terms of understanding all that stuff. And then there's also legal issues that may impede, even if you do understand, you may be the person in the publishing house that's fighting for this right along with someone like you or me. And then they're told by their legal department or by their CEO who just spent an hour with their lawyer, we can't. So
right. Well, yeah, often this, they they negotiate the rights for print only, and then they're left to scramble how to get to secure those rights for other distribution channels. So
Do you see that changing? Do you see that changing?
Well, I will say that in the current climate, you know, the economic climate, I have one book right now. I'm working on a book for Abrams at the moment, but I usually am working on three books at a time, and right now I only have one. So, you know, I hope it picks up again or that something changes. I would be happy to jump into some kind of EPUB format with these publishers because I know HTML backwards and forwards. It wouldn't be that big of a reach.
Now, it sounds like to me like you're a comic book fan, Mike, just a little bit.
Yeah, I worked in a comic book store for almost the whole time I was a teenager, as a kid. So I was the guy behind the counter that would say things like, "You don't want to read that. That's not a good comic." So, like the guy on The Simpsons, I was kind of that guy.
Right what I thought.
Yeah.
So, except cooler.
So my question for you then is, what do you think of one of the big apps, one of the first kind of breakout apps as far as getting what I guess you would say is formerly non-digital content onto devices like the iPad was, Marvel Comics and DC, all of them, they've come out with what I think are really awesome comic book apps. I was a comic book kid. I was the kid you were telling don't read that to.
Nice.
And what do you think of that? What do you think of that medium as far as seeing things that are not just text? Because, you know, if you've listened to other episodes of this show, you've heard Jeffrey and I and our guests talking about how a lot of the time EPUB is just, it's not, as you guys have already sort of identified it, it's not the best end result. What do you think of comics in that end result? What do you think of other things besides just books?
I mean, what's interesting for me is that I was an avid comic reader probably up until my first year of college, and then I just didn't have time anymore. And then I started to go back a little bit time after time, and then the iPad has really changed it for me because I read way more now than I ever did before. I mean, that includes Instapaper and iBooks and Kindle, but I'm in the middle of Batman 700 on the DC Comics app. There's also, I have a comics reader that reads archived comics, and I have a collection on my hard drive of like some of my favorite comics that I put on there, and I love it, to be honest. And the only thing that is troublesome to me is there's this assisted view in those comic apps, you know, where they zoom in on one panel at a time.
Right.
And I'm not a fan of that. If I could, I would turn that off wholesale because I like to see the whole page. You know, I'd rather zoom in to get a detail than have them zoom in for me. But I have a feeling I'm in the minority.
But during a second read, right? During it, like if you, I collected Spider-Man as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Which one?
When they were coming out.
Which one?
Amazing Tales, and then Spider-Man 1, Spider-Man 2, Spider-Man 3, you know, until I burned them all when I was 12 or something because I thought I would never get a girl if I kept reading comics. I bought cologne, and I needed to mark some transition to being a man, and I didn't quite know what that was. Actually, I'm not even going to tell that story now.
No, you have to. You have to.
No, I can't. My daughter's here, so I can't tell that story.
Oh, okay.
We'll revisit it in another show then, maybe.
No, we don't need to. So I read the Ditko Spider-Man, right? And which I loved. And now I have them again. You know, I lost them. I willfully threw them away thinking, you know, for whatever bizarre neurotic reason, and now I have them again, and I have them on my phone and on my iPad, and that's really cool. And I tend to read, you know, the home page layout too. Mm-hmm. But then I'll do it with that assisted view. So it's just to marvel, no pun intended, just to marvel at the art direction of each frame, right? Yeah. The design, the mise-en-scene of each frame, because, you know, and he's kind of like Hitchcock or something. Ditko's, I mean, there's the occasional dramatic close-up, but that's about it. He doesn't really do a whole lot with the camera, as it were. But you really do see the storytelling in a different way, frame by frame. Then, you know, there's the page view, which is like one thing. And then, I don't know. No? On a second pass?
What I do is I end up in assisted view on accident or whatever they call that. And you know, I'll stay in it for a little while, but I find myself just wanting to pinch the whole page down so I can see where that panel is in the flow. So, you know, I'm sure it'll get better over time. What I'm worried about is that they ignore the page and that we end up with just with these assisted view comics, which would be very sad to me.
Now, here's a tricky question. Mm-hmm. I remember, I mean, Chopping Block became famous mainly for Flash work, and Flash at the time, if you were a serious designer, there was almost no alternative. To be a serious designer committed to HTML and CSS seemed almost silly for many years, although that's what I did. And you did that. You did that at kind of at the height of Chopping Block success. You switched to web standards.
It's true.
I remember you telling me about it, that, and I remember it blowing my mind and making me think, well, it made me hopeful. Like, wow, well, if he can do it, if he has faith in it, maybe there's something here. So given given that background. Oh, okay. We can talk about that.
We were using at the Chopping Block, we were so ahead on Flash, we were using Future Splash Animator to do stuff. So we grew up as a shop with Flash, you know, we got in bed with Macromedia and then Adobe, and I'll tell you, that whole time I was against Flash. Completely against it. I learned HTML in 1995. I had a web page since then. You were actually the first person to ever link to me, Jeffrey.
Holy cow.
Yeah, me too. Dad? Me too.
You linked to my Tilda Mike EE account at inch.com.
From my Tilda account.
Yep, that's exactly where. And I've been, the fact that what I saw with my clients is that we would build a Flash site for them and they couldn't do anything with it. You know, we would have to build these elaborate tools to update it and then to shoehorn it into some sort of Flash interface. And again, we made these very lush, fun, like really at the time, crazy Flash interfaces. And you're right, that's what got us known. But behind the scenes, I was championing this idea of like at least a hybrid site where maybe the front page was Flash and the internal content was HTML. And, you know, I think the proof of that is that I didn't work on this project, but the Phish project, PHISH, hippie rock.
And we did the first. Castellano.
Yeah, we did the first Phish site for them, and it was all Flash, and all their users complained over and over again. And they came back, and the Chopping Block eventually did something hybrid, which was just like an embed tag on the front and the rest HTML. And we went on the last couple of years I was there, we went on to do sites more like that. And what happened was, is when I left the Chopping Block, I got your book, and I got one other really great book that I'm having trouble remembering right now. And I took the time off after I left the Chopping Block to just teach myself web standards, and I haven't really looked back since. I don't even have Flash installed on my computer.
Wow.
I can't
considering
stand it.
Considering who you are, what you've done, what you're known for, that's kind of amazing. So you're always a kind of a man without a country.
Yeah. Right? I mean, it's not the reason I left the Chopping Block, but I will tell you, it didn't help.
Okay. I do want to take this somewhere, but I find that fascinating. And I'm curious what that other book was. You read my book and Jeffine's book?
No, it was more of a tech book. Like, I could find it while we talk real quick. Hold on. I'll look for it. Semantic. The great thing about that book is it just explained everything from the point of view of the tags. It's not an O'Reilly book. It's like Making the Semantic Web or something. Maybe it'll come to me.
Okay. Is it something by John Alsop?
Wow.
Well, we'll leave it.
I mean, you know, what's funny is with what you can do now with HTML5 and jQuery, and it doesn't even occur to me to want to use Flash. It doesn't even enter into my, you know, what I want to do, you know?
Reed, no, if we're going to have John Knack from Adobe on this show in a week or two.
Yeah.
Maybe, and it's going to be fantastic. So no disrespect, but...
No, of course not,
but,
sure.
Yeah, but I also, I mean, I feel that way because, you know, I had two formative experiences. One was I lost all my music when the people who made the Akai 12 track changed their format. As soon as my machine broke, all my multi-track masters were useless. And that sort of put the idea that standards are a good thing, and you know, and proprietary technologies, even though they're exciting and give you all these possibilities, maybe you get screwed down the road. And then the other thing was, I actually spent 10 hours with Hillman Curtis's first book open on my lap, moving some letters on a site for Warner Brothers. And at the end of 10 hours, the letters moved, and it was nice. It was kind of like something you do in the movies, but it just seemed like a tragic waste. And this is not, again, not to disrespect what the Chopping Block did, what people like Josh Davis are able to do. I mean, it's amazing, and it's art, and that's all cool.
I agree with you. I think you do a little bit of a disservice to your clients, though, by giving them something that's all flash.
Right. I agree. Okay, so here's the thing. So we agree on this point. Mm-hmm. And we agree that open standards, like the open architecture of the web is a pretty good thing, and it enables it to endure and keep moving forward, and stuff you make now just keeps working, and it's accessible. It can be accessible if you do it right, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But now let's go back to the question of books and getting them online, and you're talking about comic book readers, and those are apps. And again, are we, in our enthusiasm for, or again, another example, Simple Scott, who we should probably have on the show, did this amazing book, Designing Obama. And when he chose to put it on, you know, make a digital version, he made an app, or he had an app made, that would basically give you the almost intact experience of the book on the iPad, rather than go with an EPUB where, mm-hmm. you know, here's a JPEG, here's some text, here's a JPEG, here's some text, here's a JPEG, here's some text. Because e-publications are open and transportable, and therefore very much like the early web or like mobile, right? Because they're limited in what they can do visually. Mm-hmm. A lot of us who support web standards, you know, with one part of our brains when we're doing client work, we'll go, yeah, but I really love this cool reader, or I love this book app, or, you know, the Marvel Comics thing is so great. And I'm not saying those things aren't great. I'm just wondering, you know, philosophically, there's this contradiction that we're loving both sides of, and I wonder, how can we be anti-flash or somewhat anti-flash and yet enthusiastically embrace the proprietary Marvel comic reader? Just as an example. Right.
Great question.
It's funny I'm a little hesitant to talk about archived comics or what are known as CBR files, because DC is one of my clients, but I will say that format is essentially a zip file with a bunch of JPEGs inside of it, and that's how people have been archiving comics. And I feel that even though DC and Marvel are releasing these like high-end versions, eventually all comics are going to be in this format where it's just a zipped, you know, bunch of JPEGs. So I can sleep easy, I think, knowing that'll happen. And you know, this discussion of it, like, are apps the new flash, which I think is what you're getting at, right? Like, is the content somehow buried in this thing that'll never survive? I do.
Or that just isn't open. It may survive, right?
Will it survive, though? I mean, I imagine that any app we make now in 10 years, like, what is that going to run on? An old iPad, maybe? An old iPhone? Yeah.
Right,
you know, I think that's the problem now. You know, you talk to curators at places like the MoMA, and they'll tell you, how do we archive websites? Well, you have to archive the version of the OS that it was made on, and the browser that it was made on, and you have to maintain the machine that can still run that browser. You know, it becomes very expensive. So, you know, my hope with this, the apps or Flash, is that, you know, that there's someone smart behind the scenes where the content is at least leveraged in something that's more open. And then the app is eating that content, you know, or taking that content in. And, you know, my hope would be that that content finds another venue and a more open, you know, something that's easier to get to.
But Mike, isn't that still one of the huge advantages over something like paper, especially for something like art or comic books, in that you can, you know, what you see as the creator, whether you're the designer, the artist, whatever it is, I mean, unless there's a printing screw up or something, what you see is what the people who are your consumers, who are your customers, they'll see that too, and you have mm-hmm. that control. But it's just as you said, it's almost like anything you publish on the web, and I suppose this is true of the apps that we have today too, that those things will be lost. I mean, I remember the Atari 2600 games. I wish I could play them today in the same format they were on once in a while. You know, right. I think my 3-year-old might like them too, but it's, those things are truly lost. Yeah. You can go get a ROM and an emulator. Is that what we're going to have to do to read these things in 5 or 10 years, emulate what we had today?
That's sort of what I think is going to end up happening. It's a depressing thought though.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I mean, you know, there are apps for the Mac that I would maybe, I mean, not really, but sometimes I open an old app and I'm like, oh, this won't even run in this version of OS X. And that dead forever, you know.
I have lots of stuff like that. And then there's my ex was a librarian, and they, you know, one of the things they do is they'll, you know, traditionally, so you're writing a, you know, a researcher comes, I'm doing a piece about Truman Capote, and I understand you have a collection of his letters. And they'll look at Truman Capote's letters to his friends to try to figure out, like, you know, the context of In Cold Blood, you know, what he was writing to his friends while he was writing In Cold Blood, let's say. This is this is the kind of research, as you know, because you're connected to MoMA, this research goes on and institutions collect that stuff. Like, libraries don't just collect books and archive, and they collect all this stuff. And the trouble is, let's say you wanted to do the, you know, our correspondence in Eudora on, in, you know, System 7 Macintosh.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I still have my old mail from Eudora.
That's what I was going to say. If you're such a freak that you've actually saved that on, and not just on a zip disk, but you somehow, you converted it to a jazz disk and later you, whatever. I mean,
Bernoulli box.
Right, SideQuest, all that stuff. Let's say that somehow you still have those bits somewhere that they're accessible. Someone's going to have to make eventually an emulator so you can see. I mean, unless the stuff was, I mean, maybe now that everything's being done in XHTML, well, you know what I mean? All those apps are now.
No, this happens to me more often than you'd think, because try opening an old Quark Express file now.
Right.
You know, like these publishers, sure, they've kept archives of all these books, but they're in this format that, like, You'd probably have to boot up a Quadra with an old version of Quark just to open the files.
Oh, yeah. They don't keep it at all. Basically, you'd have to go back to your Word files if you were going to, let's say, hypothetically update a book. You'd have to go back to your Microsoft Word files,
right,
and put them into the new version of Office and start editing those. But you can't just mark up. I mean, if you kept your galley, you could mark, and you were making changes, you could mark up your galley, but you couldn't just then hand it to someone who could open it in Quark and make those changes, because right, that's just there anymore. It's amazing how much stuff doesn't get saved and kept by
pre-digital.
Right. By companies where you would think that would be one thing that they do. And it's a, you know, and it's apparently not a normal best practice. Mm. Although have you followed at all, you know, Mandy Brown's article about all of us becoming archivists to try to save this stuff so that Yahoo doesn't buy and kill things? And
I guess, wow, no, I haven't read that. I'll have to read that. Huh.
Here.
Because, yeah, I mean, I find myself pulling down whole websites sometimes just to make sure that I have that content for myself.
Yeah.
You know, like a worry that it'll go away. Like, say lyrics to every Jawbreaker song. You know, I will download that whole site just to make sure it doesn't go away.
My first websites are all gone.
Yeah, mine too. I sometimes stumble upon stuff and I'm like, oh yeah, I did that like in 99. But yeah, most of it's just gone. I mean, I have backups of all of it, but I, you know, what am I going to do with it? Host it myself?
And, you know, then people think it's all on the Internet Archive, but it's not. You know, some front pages with some missing JPEGs are.
Oh, you know, actually, speaking of the Internet Archive, I was able to find that book I wanted to tell you about by looking at my old site in the Internet Archive. Which the name of that book was Cascading Style Sheets, Separating Content from Presentation.
Wow.
It's by Owen Briggs and Steve Champion.
And Steve Champion, friends. These are guys from the Web Standards Project. That's fantastic.
That book is really, that's the book. I recommend your book, that book, and now I guess I would recommend the two Alista Part books that just came out.
To see the, thank you. Well, the first CSS book that I read was by Steve Mulder, which he wrote in like 1996. Steve Mulder is more known as like a usability guy, but and I think that was called Cascading Style Sheets, We Will Have Them Soon, or Haskins style sheets.
Nice.
I have heard of them. And no, it was right after IE3 started supporting a bit of
interesting. Business. Right.
Yeah. So I think I'm running out of time here.
Yeah, we should probably close this down. So, Mike, where can people? First of all, there's something we got to plug for you.
Please.
We haven't got a chance to plug this yet. I'll tell you what. I'll let you plug it. This is so cool.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about Nerd Duo.
So Nerd Duo, the collaboration I have with Robert Gang is we try to make popular culture things. So we make everything from websites about the phrase app for that. We did a G.I. Joe t-shirt called The Battle. We just launched two extremely nerdy, very nerdy Back to the Future shirts, one of them against Star Wars. And you can find those at 1.21gigawatts.com.
Love it.
JIGGAWATTS.
And we'll have that in the show links too.
Thank you very much. I feel so naughty promoting like that.
No, this is good stuff. These are awesome, awesome t-shirts. And now tell me really quickly about this website and how you're doing like the lightning flashes and things that are going on behind it.
Sure. I mean, the lightning is all, it's just transparent 24-bit PNGs that Rob animates
so
with jQuery.
Cool. It's so
and
cool.
The lightning, it's sensitive to where your mouse is on the page, so you'll get more bolts by where your mouse is. And then the time circuit is a custom LED font that we drew and turned into a web font. And then I had to do like 2 hours of pixel perfect rendering in all the browsers to get it to line up. Fonts are close, but maybe not exactly ready for prime time. We'll see.
Next time, when I talk to type designers too, it feels in a way like, in spite of all the great work being done, like we're back in the 90s somehow with platform issues, font issues, and all that. So, Nick, I'd love to have you back on the show sometime and talk about those kind of things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We'll definitely get you back. So, thank you. Thanks very much. People can follow you at ESSL on the Twitter, right?
Indeed.
All right.
And Nerd Duo on Twitter too.
Nerd Duo too. Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for making this show so great. You can follow Jeffrey, of course, at Zeldman on Twitter. You can follow me at Dan Benjamin. And we now have 5x5 on Twitter also, which is about time. Thanks to the Twitter guys for the help with that. Thanks to Sound Studio 4. So please go download that and crush MailChimp.com. And we'll see you all again next week. Thanks, everybody. Have a good one.
Great.
Thank you.